Hello. Oh, thank you very much. So, my name is Phil, and I'm going to read a poem here about, it's entitled An Examination of a Water of Life. And this poem is about, has anybody here ever been or heard of a town called Richmond, Virginia?
Yeah.
It's a total shithole, like, don't go there. Yeah. So, I went to school in Richmond. And I always joke with people that I did three combat tours. I did one in Iraq in 2009, I did one in Afghanistan in 2011, and then I did one in Richmond, Virginia, where I went to college for 2 years. So this poem is about my sort of life in Richmond, Virginia, where I studied. It's entitled An Examination of the Water of Life. I don't write about forlorn lovers or fields of flowers. I write about 3 feet of oak and snub-nosed revolvers. Looking down, there's 3 fingers and a cocktail glass, my favorite, and I have a necklace of human ears over my sacred heart. I take a sip of sacred ishkabaha and peer at the clock on the wall, check my phone, scratch my head, and look back at the clock on the wall. And there's a well-lit altar of round glass bottles ahead. Some artists lay drowning in their sad streams of consciousness, while real men of real consequences wade through the rivers of sobriety to plant the flag of acrimonious angst in the oak. Your art is a fucking joke, your cigarettes stink, and I think I'm losing my mind. I place a small jewel in my upper lip and let the tobacco take effect, spit it out when my friend arrives. When my friend arrives, we salute each other. 2-3 fingers of Jameson's, please. Knock these 2 back and slam them down. Slam, hard and heavy as a J-dam. Outside, a hound barks like its master's name was Satanta. Cigarette butts litter the sidewalk like unconfirmed kills stretched out on the roadside. Dead eyes staring up from bloated faces, and the artists cry in their closed, silly spaces. What a piece of shit is man. Let us walk then and use cliches. Quote Henry V and speak loudly, for we were sober once, and young, and we were skinny once, and young, and I walked these streets of Richmond once without a gun, and maybe one day I'll be the same. We passed blackout windows of storefronts that smell of plastic and incense, and cashiers manned by shady, bearded men with tattooed necks who ask you when you check out if you need any batteries with that. Trash and rotting vegetables, food for the rats. Beatified bums speaking to themselves in the sky reminds us that once we saw the stars at night. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. I know I should have said it before, but these were last minute announcements. And Shane Vaughn is leaving Orwell. It's his last night here.
Aww.
Yes.
Don't believe it.
What comes with it is that there's a free position, right? Part-time administration and multimedia assistant. There is a sheet of paper on the wall there. You can read the details if you're interested. And it's a night of 2 departures. Liam over the bar is leaving us.
No.
He's going to work in the factories.
No.
Yes. So, yeah.
What a waste.
Is it sad? It is.
It is.
We don't know who we're going to get, you know? So, yeah.
It's not fact to replace him.
Sorry for the interruption. Next up on the open mic, we have Jude.
It's not titled yet. It's inspired by a recent venture I had to Limerick, to the Stanzas night. They had their festival last month, and I wrote this in the week preceding. The doorknob clicks. The hinges squeal. And you stand there, just inside the threshold, taking in the room. I imagine you've already counted the unfinished cups of whiskey. And it isn't until you've sat opposite me a while that I begin to fold away the blankets, still laid across the couch from last night. I ask you about your day, even though I can already read the answer in your eyes. And you complain for want of more time in your day as I leave the room more times, but all my thoughts are how your smell lingers in the hall where you took off your coat. I have your dinner ready. No offering of tea for today, but it's the best I could do. In this evening where your body steams the air in the damp and all I have is a hot meal to give. You look up in welcome. Only of the plate I carry. We eat in silence. A foreboding feeling that this is all we're destined for. A series of days of this. You sit in the next room now, rolling up an owl skin, shirtless, head heavy, faint hairs slip to the contours of your chest, grind, fold, spread, mold, twist and turn and lick. Come in.
Next up, we have Sue.
Oh.
Okay. Hi. I'll just read you a short snippet from chapter 4 of my first novel. It's a mystery novel about the spirits of a child's multi-generational trilogy. So this is just a snippet from chapter 4. It's set in Iraq in 1973, and this is from the point of view of a character called Abu Bashir, an elderly man who just retired. Chapter 4, Karada al-Shaqi at Baghdad, August 3rd, 1973, Abu Bashir. I need two more chickens, shouted Bismillah. Abu Bashir choked on a mouthful of sweet tea and spilled the rest of it into the saucer. He hated when his wife crept up on him like this. Why all the shouting? He wasn't deaf. Not yet, anyway. Some tomatoes, too. Make sure to get them ripe this time. I'm making bamia. Abu Bashir put his stikan of tea down with a clatter and got off the sofa. He wasn't likely to get any peace today, not with his wife fussing over the food and scurrying around like a spinning dervish. Since yesterday, the windows had been polished twice, the tile floor washed and buffed with a rag. Even the shoes he normally kept by the door were banished to the bedroom. No one had bothered to tell him this until after he'd spent a futile 10 minutes scratching his head, wondering if the thief had carried him away. Then there were his daughters, Noha and Maha, in and out all day, filling the house with their noisy brood. Not he minded the children. What he did mind, however, was Bismillah sending all five of them to fetch him from the coffee shop, just as he was about to settle to a game of dominoes with Abu Nawar and the Chaderchi. One child he could have easily popped up with a Miranda or a hard-boiled sweet, but not all five, especially not Hamid, the eldest of Maha's boys, a pudgy 8-year-old, old, whining misery that his late and lamented dad. And this was only the second day of his long-awaited retirement. Abu Bashir blew his nose with a clean handkerchief and examined its contents before storing it away in his trouser pocket. It took him a few moments of staring blankly at the floor by the door before recalling that his shoes were elsewhere. Cursing, he rushed into the bedroom, only to find that the children had tied all the shoes together by the laces. By the time he grumbled his way into the street, the asphalt radiated heat like a tarun. Within seconds, sweat spread from beneath his arms all the way across his back, plastering his shirt to his skin. On the rooftop of a nearby house, a little boy was attempting to fly a kite. With not a sigh of wind, it kept nosediving over the parapet. Though for the first time that day, Abu Bashir cursed his brother-in-law, Shaker, who was due to arrive on the following morning. He would have excused the fuss were it for the sake of Bismillah's other brother, the doctor. Now that would have been a fine thing. But this Shaker fellow was only an artist, Who cares how many degrees or awards he'd somehow managed to acquire? All he did for a living was splash paint onto canvas. Happy as he was with Umm Bismillah for a wife, Abu Bashir could have dealt without the intrusion of her precious younger brother, especially now when all he wanted was a bit of peace. Rounding the corner, he nearly collided with a young girl. "Good afternoon, Abu Bashir," she simpered. He smiled at her. Lovely girl, this Najma from next door. Uncovered, of course, like all young girls these days. But she still had the sense to cast her eyes down while greeting a man. If only his son Bashir had married Najma, so that painted harlot he'd met at college. But good is a wife with more learning than her man. An engineer, too, bossing over men older than herself. But as far as Umm Bismillah was concerned, his daughter-in-law theirs could do no wrong. By rights, they should have been at war with each other. Instead, they bonded like honey and syrup. Abu Bashir winced and glanced over his shoulder. A mere reflex, this, as Umm Bismillah was a block away and couldn't read his mind as she normally did. She wasn't called Umm Bismillah for nothing. A small woman, this Umm Bismillah, round as a kufta, her bulging eyes deceptively innocent. This served her well over the years as people often took her at face value, allowing her to sort the honest from the dishonest, to root out cheating traders, and to correct wayward children. No one, not even Abu Bashir, could remember with any certainty when she acquired her nickname. In years gone by, when such things were of value, her wolf-tooth amulets were highly prized, as were her skills in forecasting distant events. It was rumored that all she had to do was lift the corner of the carpet and the jinn would answer all her questions. Back in the village of her birth, mothers consulted her before marrying off their daughters. Young ladies who ignored Umm Bismillah's advice ruled the day with bitterness. Some of the more simple minded whispered that Umm Bismillah was a she-wolf with disguise, since wolves were destined to be the last animal to perish on Judgment Day. In spite of the upheaval of the past few days, Abu Bashir called himself lucky to be married to a woman as respected as Umm Bismillah. Their marriage, arranged with family and friends, would not have come about if it weren't for the influence of uncle, a government clerk who secured Abu Bashir, or plain Muhammad Abu Karim as he was known back then, his first job in the big city. He was a mere lad 16 in 1921 when hired as a coffee boy to work in a government department of such obscurity that even those who worked there had forgotten what it was they were responsible for. 14 years of diligence and a bit of book learning acquired from a friendly imam had brought Abu Bashir promotion to that of head of all cleaners and coffee boys. On the strength of this, he borrowed enough money from his drinking pal Shlomo Yehudi to add to the bridal money he had saved over the years. Although there were plenty of suitable brides in Baghdad, it was evident that only a girl from his own village would do for him. He'd heard all the horror stories. In a big city, a good reputation was one thing, reality quite another. More often than not, all he got for your troubles was damaged goods and a pile of grief for a speedy divorce. Girls got fake hymens for next to nothing from friendly midwives. Even big shop doctors were in on the trade. Umm Bismillah, or Ali as she was known back then, was the perfect bride. And when Bashir's sister Salma had sang her praises, only 15 years old, yet with flesh as soft as a feather bed, eyes like gazelles, breasts as firm as dew melons. Her skin was a bit on the dark side, Salma had lamented, but at least the girl was free from the scarring of the dreaded boil that afflicted so many in their village. On top of everything, her family had influence with the local sheikh, through the father who worked as the estate manager of the sheikh's sister's farm. A young man of a humble family could do much worse, was the general verdict at the time. He married the young Ali and brought her to Baghdad, where she took to cheap, bejeweled city life as if she were born to it. Soon, however, Abu Bashir was dismayed by the rigid order she imposed on the tiny segment of the house they shared with several other families. The word her perpetual tidying and cleaning continued to spend his evenings drinking with bachelor friends. This went on for a week or two, till one night, returning home reeking of cheap arak, he found his young wife waiting at the door. She begged him to keep his voice down, as there was a sick child upstairs. The devil, for who else but the devil would do such a thing, whispered in his ear, "Beat your wife regularly, even if you don't know why, she will." "Who do you think you are, woman?" he hollered, slapping her hard across the face. They sent her headlong into the earthenware pot that stood next to the copper tea samovar. Rime and olive spilled onto the floor. The noise woke the sick child. Dogs barked in the street. The crone upstairs heaped curses from everyone's head, and her consumptive son went into a fit of coughing that kept the house awake for the rest of the night. The next day, Umm Bismillah went about her duties and nothing had happened. Abu Bashir's midday meal was as well cooked as ever. Yet somehow it left a bitter taste in the mouth, as if he'd bitten on a copper spoon. Most of all, Abu Bashir was bothered by his wife's wavering gaze at mealtimes, forcing to squirm on his tufta, and advertently committing to memory the intricate pattern of fine cracks in the plaster behind her head. A day later, Abu Bashir got the first hint that his wife had extraordinary powers. He was serving coffee to the head of his department, was entertaining a visiting dignitary, when one of the men remarked to the other, "Well, you know what they say, only the wretched man beats his wife." The man gave Abu Bashir such a penetrating look that the tray rattled in his hands as he scurried out the door, spilling the rest of the coffee. And then, later that same day, as he approached two of his mates in the coffee house, he heard one of them say to the other, "He who beats his wife beats his head. He who beats his donkey beats his money bag." Without even stopping to greet them, Abu Bashir returned home to sulk in private. The following week, but the day went by without the world speaking to him in proverbs. "The home was not built on the ground, but on a woman," he overheard while waiting for the bus one morning. A boy polishing the shoes of an effendi, a dandy in a fancy pinstripe suit, remarked to the match seller, "If a man be a river, his wife be the bridge." At Friday prayers, the mullah read from the Quran, "Woman is the counterpart of man. She attires you and you attire her." At that, Abu Bashir recalled his late father telling him that the man's heart was a cabbage. He gave it away leaf by leaf, but retained the sweet core for his wife. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mary O'Connor. Mary.
This is a sonnet. It's about a man who is very happy in his work, but is now being let go because of his age. It's called Arrivals and Departures. Bucking and shuddering in a mesh of steel, his pneumatic drill made the metal dance. Constructing Stansford Airport made him feel grounded and powerful, as his grateful glance surveyed its mighty structure, with its tower soaring aloft, a place of air and light. Here he'd been happy, but now comes the hour when he'll depart for an internal flight, without a return ticket in his hand. They tell him that they have to let him go, due to his age. They feel he'll understand. He says he does, but winces at the blow, aware that ageism is now a trend. He sees a prologue to a bitter end.
Well done, sir. Thank you so much, Mary. Next up we have Bernadette Gallagher.
In two parts. Holidays. 1966. A walk and 5 miles by bus to our aunt's house. Paper and pencil, like guards, we would take down car numbers. No prize for the winner. Acting out some fantasy of Legion of Mary, we dressed up. Black and white tiles on bathroom floor. Door down to where the shop used to be. Many treasures, stories untold. 2016, cutting the grass, refilling lawnmower. Cows and neighbour pass by. Ragwort in vase, poison brightens up our day. Pinellas dug up a few days ago, made more pink, cooked with beetroot. Sit outside, eat with brew to satisfy thirst. Treasure each moment, holiday like my father, at home. Thank you.
Next up on the open mic, we have Charles Clark.
We now have Trotskyites and Stalinists in Dolera.
Yay!
They are, whoever they are, or whatever they think of themselves, a friend of mine said some years ago, being a man of the left, I said, what do you think of these people? It was a bit earlier on, they're not the same people quite. He said, I wouldn't give sixpence for any of them. However, leaving that aside, somebody mentioned, somehow or other, this came up during the week, and I realized I'd written this poem some time ago. A film, The Assassination and Death of Trotsky, based on a book which I happen to have a copy of. It's not very good. by Nicholas Moseley, also known as Lord Ravensdale. This is called Trotsky in Mexico. Did you like Burton, the Trotsky film? Very few did, it seems. A world revolutionary playing with rabbits. Correction. Feeding them lettuce. Kindness to the young. It's done for. Mexico is a country of extremes. Peasants, pushers, Zapata, Fox. There is no bread pudding in Mexico. They have bullfights. Joseph Losey made too much of that in his film. Could one deny the perverse poetry of the ice pick? A most unlikely weapon, but fit for purpose. They meant to crack through his skull. He was an intellectual, an egghead. The once impulsive leader of the Red Horde, checked outside Warsaw in 1920, struck down by Stalin's henchmen in sultry Mexico, was slower, not wiser, when he met his fate.
Thank you, Charles. Eugene Crowley.
Come down to the to give a hand. We are a generous people. Much happiness, much sadness. We dance as we pass. Chine.
Thank you. Philip.
This poem's not about to anyone, it's about lust and, you know, like a great curse in relationships where, or friendships, where the guy lusts for the girl because the girl's already taken by someone else. And the guy, he's full of dreams, he's full of wonders, I'm sure. The girl already has a boyfriend. So, anyway, enjoy. Omen hunting. So before I answer why my tummy rumbles because you're here, and why I speak to impress. Let's go omen hunting. Hunt empty ravens, because what have I told you? They're really sirens wearing crow masks, tied with black elastic bands, so you won't see them. Maybe at night they pull them off, and you see a small pale-faced girl with young breasts surrounded by bush feathers. Maybe this is where sirens hide, dressed as ravens. Let's see, can we find the smallest raven, not a crow, that's cheating. Catch it, and see, can we remove the mask? Let's see, can we gate crash a hair rabbit party? They say they look like weddings, except the hares and rabbits are redded and start sprouting antler branches with lily-like flowers. I'll pick you these flowers and give them to you. No one picks you flowers like how I pick you flowers. Let's go and sin banshee. I won't advise catching her, because it's unkind to kidnap women. They comb their aurora hair and scream midnight pitches. We can just about reach that. You have aurora hair. Let's pretend to fall asleep with horse bits hidden under pillows. So when a mare slumped their donkey heads with their big tongues lolling above us, we'll jump forwards and clap the metal into the teeth chunks. Maybe our teddies might help. So what I'm saying is, let's make an omen collection that nothing will ever dare hurt us. Instead of avoiding omens, adapting to omens, ignoring omens, spacing out when we see an omen pass, let's instead capture it and train it and make it our friend. You'll hold a siren chick on your shoulders, hug a rabbit with antlers against your breast, have atmospheric aurora hair, and you'll be holding hands with me. Holding hands with me. Let's avoid the constant truth. You said, sorry, I have a boyfriend. Thank you.
Next up, Patricia Walsh.
This is a poem I wrote today, which is an apology if it's a bit rough around the edges. It's called Country on the Moon. Imagine corners on a sphere supreme, maps and texts at a loss to quantify, exact distance from an infinite scope, coast to coast nemesis lapping the shores. The Book of Cities trammels the quotidian, guides the milestones that can carry home. The spirit of ambition knows little hounds and how, what to say, what's not to be done. The stolen garden hooks one as a steam, ripe with the fruit of a common purpose. Black iron gates knowing no fear, no cultivation of a harvest past muster. Craning necks above the parapet, exploring from a high distance a heist. Long seas from a distance seem unreasonable. Faulty discovery to call the grace. Your private locale, a history, tears to a city that you're wired to. A puckered face of pain, surprise, pulling the tides from under your feet. An endangered coast that never surprises me, drawing out severance packages away. Secret maps fast being obsolete. Water under umbrage never calls a halt. Thank you.
Next up, Cedric.
This one's entitled The Chessboard is Set, the Room Barely Lit. They sitting around a chessboard. One has no face, the other too many. The game pieces are scarce, but shared fairly. The faceless invites the first move. The faithful attacks the pitch black. His white knight shows his hooves, displays with zeal the experience he lacks. His opponent barely defends as his mistakes make the counter. He takes one fool's offense to see the kingdom falter. Of it remains the king, rook and bishop. A game the faceless could end, yet the faithful won't stop. So he lays his king with a backhand. You could feel his absent smile, a mockery and paradigm lesson, punishing vanity with a fake trial for his many daughters and sons. It was part of the growth process. In the faint light, he left them alone to see their mistakes make less. Should they understand the challenge, they'll know why God is gone.
Thank you, Sergeant. Next up, Ben Burns.
This is about a cat we used to have called Parsnip. He was as cute as the name, like. A little white cat chases butterflies in the sunlight. He stalks and pounces, snatches at wings, springs into every movement, and eats them in the grass. Brief dreams are acquainted with death. His eyes are green and alert. The garden is shimmering and silent.
Thank you. Next up on the open mic, Shameful.
All right, so I don't actually have a poem, whoops. But I do have a little story. So about 5 or 6 years ago, I moved to Cork for the first time, and I spent about a year and a half here, and it wasn't exactly the best time. It was kind of awful. And it was nothing to do with Cork. It was entirely to do with me and my place and where I was and all the things that you do in your life. And I moved away again, and I did some other stuff. And an opportunity came to go back to Cork, and I was like, oh shit, I don't know. I was there, and it was kind of crap. But I took it, and I worked with Pat Cotter in the Munsnitt Centre, and I don't know why he hired me. It was a terrible decision, but they did, and I think I gave it my all, and I really tried. And while I was there, I discovered Oveo, and then Paul said, hey, fuck it, yeah, you haven't burned down the Munsnitt Centre, come to Oveo for a while. So I did that for a year, and that's also been really, really cool. And I think I like to look at my time here in two halves. You've got the first time I came, which I didn't really like, and the second time that I have absolutely loved. And the difference between the two is the people. When I first moved to Cork, I was very insular, and I didn't go out a lot, I didn't meet new people, I didn't try and do new things, I just stuck to myself. And the second time, I really put myself out there, and I do think I've met some wonderful, incredible friends. And if any of you ever need me, I'm a message away. And I'm always going to only be a message away. So thank you to everybody who's made my time in Cork so absolutely wonderful. And I'll probably be here next week. Fuck it. I mean, I don't know why I'm getting so... you know what I mean? But I just wanted to say that. So thank you, everybody.
You might be here next week, but we'll miss you, like, you know, this kind of idea. Okay. So, yeah, rap is next. Yeah.
Gosh. Check
Jesus.
It out.
Jesus.
I was thinking to myself that I might do my Rabbi Burns thing, so here we go. My father was a farmer from up on the Carrick border, and carefully he raised me in dignity and order. He paid me act a manly part, though I never had a farthing, for without an honest manly heart, no man was worth regarding. So out into the world, my course I did determine, though to be rich was not my pitch. To be great was charming. My talents, they were not the worst, nor yet my education. Resolved was I, at least to try, to mend my situation. Through many a way and vain essay, I courted fortune's favour. Some cause unseen still stepped between to frustrate each endeavour. Sometimes by foes I was overpowered, sometimes by friends forsaken. And when my hope was at the top, I still was worst mistaken. And then sore harassed and tired at last, with fortune's vain delusion, I dropped my schemes like idle dreams, and I came to this conclusion. The past is dead, the future's hid, it's good or ill untried. But the present hour is in my power, and so I will enjoy it.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Rob. And now for something completely different. We have a Joe Harpist here, and it's not me. It's Victor. Woo! ready? I handed the mic now, and we'll try to set the sound right, okay? Do some couple tries there. Brilliant. Lovely.
Oops.
You can do it.
Just blew it.
Go on.
No. Take it. Thanks.
Thanks, Victor. Okay, our last act for tonight, Christy Parker.
I'm just going to read a poem that I wrote. Similar to Patricia, I sure what this city as well. And I haven't a clue what it's about, to be honest about it. I don't understand it myself. And it's about me. It's called Misunderstood. When a friend informed me of the outcome of Britain's Brexit vote, I was absolutely stunned. That anyone should think I give a puppety fuck about Britain's place in European affairs left me reeling. I don't give a shite, I replied with unconcealed contempt. And I especially don't give a shite at 5 o'clock in the morning, you bastard, I added with enhanced feeling. I hate people. Don't get me wrong, I've known some decent blokes. Father Thomas, for example, who lived two doors down from me. He was a fantastic priest when it came to hearing confessions. He told me everything. Although, as he requested, I had kept the information to myself. We might still be friends. And he might not have been arrested. I hate courtrooms. But more than anyone else, I hate the New Games Review Committee of the International Olympic Council. Just maybe, they had a right to decline my suggestion. But they were well out of order 79 times calling me names. And I will not abandon the fight to have mackerel fishing take its rightful place in the Olympic Games. I hate snobs. Nothing annoys me more than the checkout girl in Aldi pronouncing, "Hello, how are you?" after I have already told her 9 times about my 5 incurable diseases, my imminent blindness, and my constant agony from piles. "That is not possible," she says when I ask for a discount on my bag for life. $16.95, sir. Cash or card? She smiles. I hate supermarkets. I hate cruelty to animals, but I can seldom resist giving my neighbor's dog a few hefty kicks. She's a mangy old terrier bitch that had 13 litters and is always begging for attention. But he named her Miriam O'Callaghan. Sometimes it's okay to make an exception. I hate TV license fees. But the world wants to love me as it woos me with offers and discounts, texts me about freebies, savers and bargains and many, many more. And when I complain, it assures me that my call is important to us, even recorded for training purposes, as smooch music fills my head, adding more rhyme and more reasons as to why I wish only to remain in my bed. I hate alarm clocks. Thank you.